Mr. Goodman.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the clerk in the front. This is an unusual case.
It's unusual in large measure because the respondent is the warden of a prison in Kansas, and this ain't Kansas, as was said to Dorothy memorably. Never has been Kansas. What are we doing here?
I don't believe that that issue was resolved favorably by
the gentleman. It may have been resolved favorably, but it looks very much like the Supreme Court held in Ahrens against Clark that this is a question of federal subject matter jurisdiction. And jurisdictional issues cannot be waived or forfeited, so the fact that the United States has chosen not to raise it can't matter. In fact, in Ahrens itself, the United States specifically waived the issue in the Supreme Court so that the merits could be reached. And the justices said that can't be done. This is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, in this particular case, the original petition was filed while...
Yes, against a respondent in Illinois at the MCC.
That's correct.
That was dismissed.
It was dismissed without prejudice.
Exactly. And then by the time a new petition was filed, your client was in Kansas.
That's correct.
Well, and one would think, therefore, the petition had to be filed in Kansas.
And, you know, we briefed this issue before the district judge. And
I understand you briefed it before the district judge, but as I say, under Aaron, this appears to be an issue of subject matter jurisdiction. What permits the Northern District of Illinois to exercise jurisdiction over a warden in Kansas? You may know that about 3 weeks ago, we released an opinion in Almari against Rumsfeld saying that it just can't be done. And it is very hard to see why we should, certainly shouldn't be thinking about overruling Almari 3 weeks later.
Well, may I address the merit, Your Honor?
Sure.
Thank you.
Jurisdiction is important.
In this particular case, the state put together a purely circumstantial case against the federal parolee and a contradictory murder case. And I say contradictory because the state's star witness, the woman that was with the defendant and the victim on the night that the victim disappeared, says that the defendant dropped the victim off outside of a home in Round Lake and could not have killed him. As sometimes happens with weak cases, it got stronger a month before trial when a jailhouse informant came forward. He was convicted by a jury. It was reversed outright on appeal. And the Federal Parole Commission has essentially looked at the same evidence and said, it's good enough for us, and revoked Mr. Moore's parole. The law, I don't believe there's any dispute about the law in this case. Mr. Moore, a parolee, has a liberty interest. It's protected by due process. And there's a preponderance standard at the revocation hearing. On review of a revocation, the district court must determine whether there was a rational basis in the record to support the board's conclusion. The district court is not required to comb through the record. But in this case, there's a dispute about what is in the record. There's two main points of dispute, and they involve a witness named Etta Bunch and the jailhouse informant. With respect to Ms. Etta Bunch, the commission found that she gave statements which implicated Moore in the murder. The lower court accepted this without checking. In fact, we have attached all of Ms. Bunch's statements. In each and every one of her statements, she states that Mr. Horton was dropped off in Round Lake and did not get back into that van. The second point of dispute involves the jailhouse informant, Jimmy Crawford. The Illinois Appellate Court disposed of Mr. Crawford's testimony in a single paragraph, finding it so untrustworthy it cannot be used to support defendant's conviction. The commission was not bound by that finding. We don't allege that it was. But it was bound to provide a rational basis for its contrary finding that Mr. Crawford was a credible witness. It gave two demonstrably false explanations for its finding. One, it said that there was no way this informant could have known non-public details about the offense. This was belied by the record, where two witnesses from the jail testified exactly as to how Mr. Crawford could have learned non-public details about the offense. Secondly, the commission stated that Moore gave false testimony at the hearing about not knowing Crawford. We've attached that testimony in the brief. It's clear from that testimony that his testimony was not false. He never denied knowing Mr. Crawford. He said that he did not recognize him at first when he showed up at trial because he had shaved his beard. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for a rebuttal, if I may. Thank you.
Certainly. Ms. Hunt.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, I will start with the jurisdictional issue because the government did not address that in the brief.
Addressing subject matter jurisdiction is the first duty of every lawyer.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that what happened in the case was we sort of took the approach that, well, we had attacked whether the district court could assert personal jurisdiction over this particular warden. And so since we lost on that issue but we won on the merits, we thought that, well, we should just go ahead and address the merits of the case because we didn't realize that there was this other issue out there. So if the court would like, I'm more than happy to submit some kind of supplemental jurisdictional memo within the next couple of days addressing the Omari case.
Not simply Omari, it's rather long chain of cases on which it's based, and the language of 2241 and several other bases. But yes, I'll give the parties 10 days to file supplemental memos on the jurisdictional issue. You should also address the question whether the aspect of Ahrens against Clark, which holds that this is a question of subject matter jurisdiction, survived the overruling of a different part of Ahrens against Clark in Braden against Kentucky.
Yes, Your Honor.
Part of that is also discussed in Elmari.
I will certainly submit that. On to the merits. Mr. Moore claims that there is a dispute about what's in the record here, but really there is not. Clearly, there was no real consistent story from Ms. Bunch, who was the witness that the parole commission based a portion of its determination upon on as to what happened in this case. But what the parole commission had to do was to simply parse through all of the evidence that had been presented, and then from that, make a determination as to what was the most likely story here. What Mr. Moore is asking this court to do when he says that, well, there's no testimony from Ms. Bunch that directly implicated Mr. Moore in this murder, is he's asking the court to go far beyond the limited standard of review that Congress and this court has held, a reviewing court has, when they're looking at these parole commission decisions. The parole commission took into account Ms. Bunch's testimony. It made credibility determinations. She testified at the hearing. It had the opportunity to hear what she had to say. She gave a number of different statements. The government does not contest that. Contrary to what Mr. Moore suggests in his reply brief, the government is not attempting to mislead the court and have the court believe that there was only one story that was given. There was not. There were a number of different stories given. But what the parole commission did was it took all of that and then it provided a rational basis for its decision that it was more likely than not that Mr. Moore was involved in this murder. As to the jailhouse informant, Mr. Crawford, once again, that testimony was presented. Mr. Moore could have called, subpoenaed Mr. Crawford to appear at the revocation hearing. He wasn't prevented from doing that. Mr. Crawford is not in prison, so he could have been available. And the commission found that there was a way that Mr. Crawford could have known about this non-public detail about the killing, Mr. Moore could have told him. That once again goes to a credibility issue, which is entrusted to the discretion of the commission and not for a reviewing court to come back and reweigh the evidence and decide that, well, we think that it should have been decided a different way. And so for those reasons, we think that the record does show that there is a rational basis for this decision. The commission laid that out in its decision, and that's all that it is required to do. The fact that Mr. Moore believes that the commission could have found a different way does not change that and does not allow a reviewing court to go back and suddenly conduct this de novo review of all of the evidence and the credibility of the witnesses that were before the commission. Unless the court has no further questions, we ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Goodman.
Thank you for the opportunity to brief the issue. 2 points. Regarding Ms. Bunch's statement, Ms. Hunt has stated that what the commission did is parse through her statement. That is not what the commission did. What the commission did is selectively use statements by Ms. Bunch about hearing voices and assuming that the victim got back into the van and ignoring the rest of the paragraph or the end of the paragraph where Ms. Bunch says, but when I looked, he wasn't in the van. With regard to Jimmy Crawford, according to what Ms. Hunt has told you, is that all the commission did was say, we find him reliable because there was a way he could have learned non-public information from Frank Moore. In fact, that's not what the commission said. What the commission said was that there was no way he could have learned this non-public information but from Mr. Moore. That is an absolutely, entirely false statement. There was a way, and there's evidence in the record, and had the district court looked at the record to resolve the disputes, it would have seen that the commission's interpretation of the record was not correct. And I would say that this is analogous to a situation where you basically have no evidence in a record pointing to somebody, except this could be a case where you have the only evidence in the record is a confession produced by torture. Would that be enough evidence?
I actually don't see what difference any of this makes, since parole can be revoked for the infraction of any law, and your client concedes using drugs. That's a perfectly good ground for revocation of parole. What difference does it make whether he also murdered his supplier?
He would be out by now if that was the ground for the revocation.
He hopes.
No, he would be, Judge. There are specific guidelines for the length of a sentence that he could have gotten for the marijuana violation.
No, there's a difference between guidelines and legal rules.
Well, I think that having a finding of, he has a due process right not to be found guilty of a murder, whether it's before a parole revocation.
Paul against Davis says that there's no such right. No right not to be defamed by a government.
Well, he certainly has a right to his liberty, and according to the parole guidelines, I believe it's about a 6 or 9 month maximum sentence for a marijuana violation.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Judge.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Goodman. We appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment, and we look forward to your continuing assistance as we try to unravel this jurisdictional issue. The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until